Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show, Christy, excited that we're going to have back on our show the Dean of the UNC School of Medicine and CEO of UNC Healthcare, Dr. William Roper, talking about the pressures on academic health centers. We feel it, and I'm sure that he'll be able to help us talk about it.
I know. Looking forward to having this conversation. But first, we've got some good research that matters about injections for knee arthritis, about mind and body rest with concussion healing,
about this supplement called selenium, and finally about a new type of insulin called Lantus, and is it safe and effective?
Okay, well, first we'll talk about injections for knee arthritis. So, I know you, Adam, must have as many patients as I do who have osteoarthritis of the knees and other body joints. A lot of it's related to weight, but it's really common, and people suffer from this type of arthritis.
Not only that, Christy, the common treatments, other than joint replacement, include that steroid injections. But there was this process that came about a decade ago, where they injected cartilage into the knee, and a lot of people now get that, and that cost up to $1,000 for one course of artificial cartilage. And the question is that really effective?
And so this lubricating substance, the hyaluronic acid.
Artificial cartilage.
Exactly. is something that, you know, makes sense that if you kind of gave a lubricating substance in there, that it would be a little easier to move and maybe less painful to move your joints.
Until you look at the research.
I know. So there was a study.
Meta-analysis.
From the Annals of Internal Medicine. This was published looking at 89 past clinical trials, taking out the 18 largest trials, and really found that there are very minimal effects and some side effects.
Yeah, when the beneficial effects tended to be in the smaller trials, but when you looked at the larger trials, there was very little effect. And there the side effects, including potential infection or inflammation and swelling in the joint after the treatment. And I think it really calls into question if the effect is minimal clinically, is this something that we should be recommending to our patients?
I certainly think a take-home message here for our listeners, if you have osteoarthritis or if your loved one does, to really talk to your doctor about what are the possibilities. If these injections don't work, are you somehow different than the larger group? Are you out of options before knee replacement, in which case it might be worth a try? But you should know about the side effects and the low sort of promise that it'll make a big difference.
Well, let's talk about our next research that matters, Christy, about concussions and rest.
So this was a study published in the Journal of Pediatrics looking at people who have suffered a concussion to see if taking a complete week off from nearly all mental and physical activity, including television, talking on the phone, visiting with friends, was linked with improved mental performance and symptoms.
I think, Christy, having a week off from virtually anything for any condition, you might have some improvement in some
I think my mental performance would improve.
But they actually took athletes here who had had concussion, and 14 of the athletes started their rest within a week of their injuries, 22 started their rest a month after their concussion, and 13 started their rest 1 to 7 months after their concussion.
And what they found were that all of the symptoms improved dramatically. The patients did better on all of the mental exams after they rested. But the thing about the study is they didn't compare the improvements of the participants who fully rested with other people who had concussions who didn't have the special type of rest.
Right. And certainly those who seemed to have the rest who were treated earlier did better after the rest than those who had it later, but they may not be the same patients after you've had concussions that haven't been treated for for months compared to those who get treated right off the bat. So we don't know. This isn't a randomized controlled trial, but it does raise, I think, interesting questions about how we treat concussions and listeners, how you and your family members maybe should have a concussion treated. Is it harmful to take on more rest after concussion?
Yeah, it really, I mean, other than, you know, potential issues with schools and jobs and that sort of thing, minor details. but I think if my child were playing soccer and she had a concussion, I would really focus on getting her full rest as soon as possible and let people figure out the evidence later on. It's, I mean, it has promise.
Yeah, I think this is an underutilized modality and something that I'm going to start talking about more because, like you said, Christy, it's relatively cheap. And maybe a doctor's note to an employer may get someone a little bit more rest.
Let's talk about selenium. This is a study linking selenium with lower diabetes risk.
Yeah, this was in the journal Diabetes Care. And it comes from this longstanding study called the Nurses' Health Study, where 7,000 women and men were followed over decades, and they looked at their actual selenium in their toenails. I say that again, selenium in their toenails from the 1980s, and then looked at their development of diabetes a decade or two later.
What they found were that the chances of developing type 2 diabetes were, you know, in the range of 24% lower among the people who had the high selenium in their bodies than among the people who didn't take that much of that mineral and didn't have very much in their bodies.
And this doesn't say that they were taking selenium supplements. They weren't. This is most likely that was due to their diets, where fruits and vegetables and nuts and grains, those type of practices lead to higher selenium. So there's some thought that those were the reasons why they had higher selenium in their toenails. And I think it's premature to say, oh, we should recommend selenium supplements for people to lower the risk of diabetes. I don't know what you're thinking, Christy.
Well, also, selenium levels in the United States are already pretty high because of selenium that's in soils and parts of the country. So I think I would not go out and start taking selenium. But I think we're starting to chip away at these different factors that could help us tease out and reduce our risk for diabetes. The best thing you can do to reduce your risk for diabetes is lose weight.
Let's ask our health science resource librarians to put some information about the normal adult recommendations of selenium, which is 55 micrograms a day, and some sources of selenium, like a bagel, which is 27 micrograms of selenium.
Okay. I bet they'll do that happily. Let's talk about the last research that matters about cancer risk with Lantus, or lack of cancer risk with the insulin Lantus.
Yeah, there were a couple articles that were presented at the American Diabetes Association annual meeting, Christy, that deal with this new type of insulin. I say relatively new because 5-7 years ago, this was not something that we were routinely prescribing. We were giving them this NPH and this other type of insulin, and there's this now, for the last number of years, a once-a-day longer-acting insulin, and the question is it safe in terms of potentially promoting cancer, and is it potentially healthier for patients in some other ways of giving insulin?
So the regular name for Lantus is the insulin glargine. And so
G-L-A-R-G-I-N-E. That's a hard one to say.
It is a hard one to say. But it is a once-a-day insulin. The new study that came out, and you know, one of our researchers at the University of North Carolina here was very involved in this.
Yeah, Dr. John Buse, who's an international expert in diabetes. And basically, they looked in the risk of cancer for patients who had been on this new type of insulin compared to the older types of insulin, because there was some concern there might be an elevated risk of breast cancer, but there really was no increased risk when these patients followed for up to 6 years with this newer form of insulin.
Yeah. So, I mean, they found no increased risk of any of the type of cancers that they were looking at, including breast cancer, among the new glargine or Lantus users compared with those who are using that NPH older insulin when they followed for about a year, and there are other ones that have followed for longer periods of time.
We may need to talk, Christy, about the whole change in diabetes care, because there's so many new medicines, and is this medicine better than some of the pills, and are the side effects, because you can still get a low blood sugar with this medicine. I think we need to probably...
We need to have a new show on diabetes, don't we?
Yeah, well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show, Christy. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. William Roper about the pressures of academic health centers. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Adam and I have the great fortune of talking with the Dean of the UNC School of Medicine, Dr. William Roper, about the pressures on academic health centers. Dr. Roper is also the Vice Chancellor for Medical Affairs and Chief Executive Officer for the UNC Healthcare System. Welcome, Dr. Roper.
Glad to be here.
Welcome back, I should say.
Delighted to be back.
You know, Dr. Roper, I think the last time we had you on the show a couple years ago, we were talking about how an academic health center really meets its commitment to underserved. And while I think we could still talk about that, I know we'll touch upon that today, Christy and I just deal all the time with the pressures of an academic health center. And I think we wanted to really delve into that. And what's it like being the CEO and the leadership of a $1-2 billion healthcare system?
Well, we are now about a $2.5 billion enterprise.
Sorry about that.
That's okay.
Wow, don't underestimate.
Keeping the numbers straight. Thanks for the invitation to talk about what I do. I count it a blessing to be able to do what I do. Somebody has said that academic healthcare organizations, academic medical enterprises, are the most complex organizations in America. It comes about because we have many different missions, and I'll talk about them in a moment briefly, and we have many different constituencies that we're trying to serve, and we are much like the metaphor about the blind men touching an elephant, because most people interact with part of our organization, but rarely does any single individual see or touch or feel or experience all of what we do.
And thinking about you and the effort that it's taken to accomplish what you had to get to this position and what seems like would be a very stressful job to juggle all this. What is the thing about this? Like, why do you put your life's work and effort into this? Well, I mean, why? We know it's important, but talk to us about why it's important to you.
I count it a real blessing and opportunity to do something that matters, that makes a difference. And it's a calling, a vocation, if you will, in the classical sense of that word. Every job I've had up until now has been a surprise. So I'm not one of those people who, when he was 3 years old, decided he was going to do something and everything down the road has been building on that. It's been a surprise, but happily, a very good surprise that brought my wife and son and I to Chapel Hill 15 years ago this month, first to the School of Public Health, and then 8 years ago to the medical school and the healthcare system. We're an institution that is proud of what we do. We like to say it's our aspiration, our vision, to be the nation's leading public academic healthcare organization. That's a pretty ambitious goal, I readily acknowledge. There are many other fine academic medical organizations, even here in North Carolina. But we think the thing that makes us distinctive is we are a public institution. And just like the famous Charles Kuralt statement about Chapel Hill, the university of the people, well, we are the healthcare system of the people. And we think there are some things that flow from that and obligations that come from that that really make us who we are.
Well, you know, there's not many, at least I'm aware of, leaders of healthcare systems that have the type of experience that you do from government in your days with Medicare and the Centers for Disease Control, then into the private Prudential, I think, and then coming into the dean of a school of public health. So you have a very unique, I think, viewpoint from it. And I wonder what has changed, though, because today we talk about, if you were to go look at the financial health and you used your historical vision the last 3 years, you would say the financial health of an academic health center is wonderful. They're making money and they've made generous sums. but the pressures seem so acute and people feel, what has changed?
Yeah. I think the thing that is most pressing on us these days is the realization that America is in the process of deciding, if I can put it that way, that healthcare is too expensive. I say is in the process of deciding because not everybody has come to that conclusion. But I think if you look out over the next hill in the dim mists ahead, it's real clear that senior leaders in government or in the business community or just average Americans are saying, in effect, Bill Roper, what in the world is the explanation for this stupendous cost of healthcare? Now, we're going to struggle with that as a nation, but one of its implications, I believe, is a sustained and forceful downward push on the cost of healthcare. And like it or not, academic medical centers like us are the high-cost spread. We're the people that do this the most expensively. And so the impact of this downward pressure that I'm forecasting is going to come most acutely on organizations like us. And so we are trying to anticipate that and get ready for it, but it's going to be pretty intense.
Well, and it's not only are we the ones maybe that have the highest cost of healthcare, but also many would argue that the academic health centers are the ones charged as leaders, as think tanks, sure, as the people to forge the way to solve in healthcare reform. So I wonder how you're balancing those two of how to respond and also how to really lead the change.
Well, all that is true, Christy, but the point I think you're making, I would elaborate briefly and say we do teaching of medical students and residents and other learners. We do research to discover the best way to diagnose and treat all kind of ailments and to do prevention and so on. And we care for people, all sorts of people from all over the place, but especially people who have no other place to go because they can't afford it. And that comes together to be this complex organization that I was describing. And it is stupendously expensive. But since no single North Carolinian or no single American experiences all of those things, they simply experience it as, hey, you guys are real expensive, and can't you figure out a way to do this more cheaply? Hmm. And that's what I'm believing we're going to have to do, like it or not.
We're talking with Dr. William Roper, Dean of the UNC School of Medicine and CEO of UNC Healthcare. And Dr. Roper, in thinking about the real pressures that are here, what has UNC or academic medicine done well in the last 5 years in terms of responding to these pressures? And what perhaps have we not done well enough?
Yeah. One of the things that we've done here at our place is begin to try to anticipate this coming change that I'm describing. And one aspect of that anticipation is a partnership that we have forged with Blue Cross of North Carolina to create a new way of caring for people with chronic and complex illnesses that we call together Carolina Advanced Health. It's a 50-50 joint venture between us and Blue Cross, sharing in the creation of a new clinic pretty close to the intersection of Interstate 40 and Highway 54 that's enrolling people with chronic illnesses like heart disease and lung disease and mental illness and diabetes and so on, and trying to bring to bear all the latest in care and anticipatory guidance and nutrition and
So fundamentally changing how a practice, you could conceive of a practice.
Yeah, changing the way healthcare is organized and delivered. We're learning a lot. Not everything that we try is going to work, but we're learning a lot. And I'm believing, we're believing, that will help us, help guide us in basically remaking everything that we do, because the way healthcare has been organized in the past around the fee-for-service or piecework model, where if you do more of something, you get paid more of it. That, I think, is going away, and something different is coming into its place, and we've got to get prepared for that. The other thing I just mentioned that we're working on, and you all as family physicians will be right at the forefront of this, is focusing our attention on the health of the population, not just Bill Roper and Adam Goldstein as individuals, but what are we doing to improve the population's health in, take your pick, North Carolina or Orange County or Chapel Hill? And I think it's incumbent on us as a leading academic health system in this area to step up to the plate and take responsibility for even people that are not now our patients.
And it's, for us, we can think about that from a population level of within our family medicine center. But I'll be interested as we carry on to the next segment to talk about how you think about that when you're leading the state of North Carolina as a public academic health center. We are going to take a short break, but when we come back, we will continue talking with our guest, Dr. William Roper, about the pressures on academic health centers. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. William Roper, Dean of UNC School of Medicine and CEO of UNC Healthcare, about the pressures on academic health centers. And Dr. Roper, right before we broke, you gave us some nice examples, I think, of some of the innovations that are occurring to help perhaps solve some of the pressures. But one of the pressures, I think, that we see here in Chapel Hill and Durham and Raleigh is we have large healthcare systems that are competing with one another. Mm-hmm. How does UNC Healthcare or any academic health center that's in such an environment, and they're all over the country, deal with those types of pressures and give us some insight?
Sure, sure. It's a part of our daily work. The most immediate competition we have is from our neighbors to the north in Durham at Duke. It's an extremely good academic health organization. And as I drove into your parking lot, I see there's a Duke Medicine outpost here in the neighborhood. And we have others, Wake Med in Raleigh, and Novant is buying practices in this area. To the west in Alamance County, we have others. I think it's important for your listeners to understand that what is happening right now in healthcare is people are choosing sides. And what I mean by that is individual doctors and hospitals are teaming up together because they find the pressures of delivering medical care and organizing themselves efficiently. It no longer works to be in solo practice or a small hospital out by itself, that larger organizations make sense. Now, in trying to describe this recently, I made the point that it was what is happening in healthcare is rather like what happened in the 80s in the banking industry when banks consolidated, and the person that was interviewing me said, well, how'd that work out for you? So you got to be aware of the analogies that you use. So I'm not claiming that this is a perfect thing, and there are going to be some mistakes that are made along the way, and we may well make some of those mistakes. But I think it's undeniable that there's a consolidation underway in healthcare. Some people think that's a good thing. Some people hate it. I happen to believe it's, on the whole, a good thing, because scale, larger organizations allow for more sophisticated information technology systems and sharing of insights and standardization of care in ways that are good for patients and their outcomes. On the other hand, coming together in large organizations has to diminish the autonomy that individual practitioners have and you know, one of the things that draws people, or at least in the past has drawn people into medicine, is the ability to, quote, do things the way I want to do them without anybody telling me what to do. I'm afraid those days are rapidly vanishing in the rearview mirror.
When thinking about what some would consider healthy competition of mm-hmm. big academic health centers near each other, and our commitment to our state and thinking about the population, as we were discussing briefly sure. in the last segment, how do we respond to that being this big academic health center competition all right here in the Triangle, and yet we've got many counties that are yeah. health shortage areas that we really need to be reaching out to? How do yeah. you weigh that in?
Well, we are in a high growth area. I think the Triangle region, North Carolina, may be one of the top three or four growth areas in America. And so if it is any solace to your listeners, they ought to believe that we're going to need lots of health care over the coming decade or two here. So I think there's very little risk that we're going to overbuild capacity here. But then you ask a different question, and that is, well, what about everybody else that gets left out? If all the practitioners are in urban or suburban areas, what happens to the folks in the rural areas? And, you know, smart people have worked on that question for quite a while, and I'm not going to claim it to have any particular blinding insight. But I think it has to be that we find alternate ways to deliver medical care in rural areas than having every small hospital in North Carolina or beyond continue the way it always has been. I know some people find it very upsetting to think that their, you know, 40 or 50 bed hospital might close. But I think if we can find ways in the more rural parts of our state to convert the mission of small hospitals to be sophisticated emergency departments that can provide immediate care and then transport patients, probably that is the best thing for the patients who are being cared for in that county and beyond. But I say that recognizing the fact that in those same small rural counties, that hospital is probably the largest employer in the county and is a major economic force thereby. Mm. And so these are wrenching changes that we're going through. But to come back to the urban area here, we are much the better because we are competing with Duke, just to cite the present example. They keep us on our toes, and we like to think we do the same for them. But we also do many things in collaboration. My counterpart at Duke, Victor Zhao, and I get together about once a quarter and talk about how we can foster even more collaboration between our institutions. That does not involve basketball, I hasten to add, but there are lots of things that we can do together medically.
Well, you know, one of the things, putting back your hat as a in public health, but also as a pediatrician, our listeners should know that you're a pediatrician, yep. is we are the only industrial large country in the world of a size like ours that doesn't have a national healthcare system. It doesn't appear that we are going to adopt a European-type system in my lifetime. But what's the role, if any, of an academic health center in advocating for that type of policy or not?
Yeah. I think it's part of our role to be prophetic and to talk to the leaders of our society and say we simply have to do better. The fact that 50 million Americans don't have health insurance and thereby don't have full access to the medical care that they need is not just a problem for them and their family. It's a problem for all of us because they will seek care later and have worse outcomes and thereby be a burden on the rest of society and unproductive as workers or in other ways. And that is a cost to all of us. And so we ought not have the sort of radical individualist view that, well, that's their problem, and I'm going to take care of myself, because we are paying a heavy price as a nation for not having a more communitarian view of things. Now, that's not to say we need a one-size-fits-all. I'm from the government. I'm here to help you with your health care. But we can do a whole lot better than we currently are.
You've been leading our organization during these times of rapid change, major pressures, unsure horizons. What have you learned the most in this role, and what has been fun?
Well, I get to have lots of fun. I hasten to add, I get to work with smart, dedicated people who are making a difference every day for North Carolina and beyond. I think what I've learned is at the end of the day, what works in decision making, and this is going to sound smarmy and whatever, but it is true. If we can keep our eye on what's good for the people we serve, in particular, keep our eye on what's good for the patients that we serve, we'll probably be making the right decisions. It's not always easy. There are competing tensions that pull us one way or another. But I'm willing to put my trust in that decision framework, that let's do the right thing for the people out there.
Well, we know it hasn't been easy always, but you're smiling a lot.
Yep,
That's a good sign anyway.
That's what my wife tells me.
Well, we appreciate you taking the time to come here and share your perspectives about UNC healthcare, about American society, the North Carolina, with the listeners of Your Health. This is a huge issue. We know it's pressuring. We appreciate what you do for UNC healthcare, but also for the people of North Carolina and beyond.
Absolutely. Thank you, Dr. Roper.
Thank you, Dr. Page and Dr. Goldstein.
We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Christy, we're going to talk about your listeners' health questions and concerns.
And if you have a question you'd like for us to address, we want you to send your comments. Email us at yourhealth@unc.edu.
Where's that?
yourhealth@unc.edu.
Okay.
Or go to our blog, Twitter, Facebook, app on your smartphone. Lots of ways to reach us and give us your questions and comments.
Well, we've got some really good questions today. House calls about how long do you have to have a tick on before it can cause a problem?
About how often people need to see their doctor as they get older.
About if you get a bill, like from the emergency room, and you don't believe it's right, what do you do?
And about the difference between asthma and reactive airway disease and how that makes sense for a child.
Well, let's listen to our very first house call.
If you take a tick off of you after it's been on you for less than an hour, can you still get Lyme disease?
You know, that's a great question. Great question. Because I wondered the same thing when I first heard this. Like, well, God, how long does it take to cause Lyme disease or Rocky Mountain spotted fever?
Well, and I'm not sure if there's a difference in my yard or if it's just the age of my children being outside. But
how sweet you are, Christy.
We are picking off ticks off of our children. I probably get 10 off of each child a day. And multiple times a day. And then they'll just go out to the porch for something and back, and there's another tick on them.
That's not good.
No, it's not good. But
the good news is that
they really, a tick needs to feed on a person's blood, and they become engorged and feed on the blood for at least six hours to transmit illness when you're thinking about Rocky Mountain spotted fever
or
starry, those things.
Kinds of, right.
But Lyme disease, it's the listed amount of time is 72 hours. So 25% risk if they've been fed on you for at least 72 hours. And the literature suggests zero to almost zero risk if they've been on you or fed your blood for less than 72 hours. That's a long time.
So, Christy, if I came in, I had my tick on for less than an hour, and I said, I want some antibiotics because I don't want to get that Lyme disease, what would you tell me?
You know, I would say that's probably not a great idea. But, because, I mean, most ticks don't care. Right. But I would say mark your calendar. I mean, for any tick exposure, mark your calendar. And if you or your child gets a high fever in the next 3 weeks, then come and talk to your doctor about it.
Good advice.
Thank you.
Let's listen to our very next house call.
I'm a little confused by the articles in the New York Times that say people do not need to see their doctor every year as they get older. Is that just for healthy older people?
Well, you're not alone in being confused out there. I've had a lot of patients and family members say, well, Adam, you know, that advice you've been giving me that I don't have to get a mammogram when I'm 85, well, maybe that's correct after reading about it in the New York Times.
Well, the truth is that a lot of those screening tests that we do for breast cancer, pap smears, different tests, as you get older, there are recommendations saying that you don't need those anymore. That needs to be individualized and talked with. You need to talk to your doctor about that. But in terms of going to see your doctor at all,
If you're healthy.
I mean, I think it depends because most people, as they're older, have some sort of chronic medical condition, be it blood pressure, cholesterol. There are lots of different things that people may be on medicines for, in which case you do need to be following with your doctor.
But if you're really healthy, you were on no medications, you probably don't have to see the doctor certainly as frequently as perhaps we've kind of traditionally told people in the past. But you know what? If you want to go in on a regular basis to talk about questions, and this is the part that the New York Times article didn't discuss, talking to your doctor is actually an undervalued service. Ordering of tests and blood works may be overdone for healthy people as they get older. But these are great conversations. And ask this question to your own doctors.
I think having conversations about safety and about planning for your future and about your goals of how you want your end of life to be, those are conversations that are important to have with your doctor, even if they're not prescribing you a specific medication.
Or even how long that tick has to be on.
Exactly. Okay, let's take our next house call question.
I received a bill from my emergency room that had charges on it that I did not think I had to pay. My insurance company said the ER doctor billed them as if it was not an emergency, so my benefits for ER care were not relevant. But when I had chest pain, how was I supposed to know before it was evaluated that it was only spasms in my stomach? This seems unfair. Do you have any advice?
Well, that is unfair. And thank you for sharing that story with us because, you know, it's true. When you come into the emergency room, you're scared. You're having what you think could be a heart problem or something like that. And then they tell you at the end, well, no, it was just reflux of acid. And you feel like, oh, I'm stupid. And then you feel really bad, but maybe even angry when you get a bill and the insurance company says, oh, this wasn't an emergency. You owe more money.
It doesn't make sense to me that they would make more money by charging you the non-urgent fee versus the urgent fee. But regardless, this is the sort of thing you want to follow up on. You need to call the insurance company and disagree and try to find out what documentation you need.
Well, the insurance company might not have to pay out if it's they may give you full benefits if it's a emergency room visit, but if it's kind of an outpatient care visit, it may not be a non-urgent visit.
So calling the billing office.
Everyone has different incentives, but the point here is really important is that if it doesn't make sense to you, it may not be sensical, and you actually can appeal the decision and get more information.
Talk to your doctor about that if you're confused. Talk to the billing services at the hospital or at the place of the emergency department.
Get a patient advocate that can help you understand this bill.
That's right. We think you should fight it.
Well, at least question it. So let's listen to our very last house call.
My grandson had a persistent cough and shortness of breath on exertion. Because of family history, I was concerned that he might have asthma and took him to the doctor. The pediatrician said he does not have asthma and gave him an inhaler for reactive airway. Can you explain what reactive airway is?
Good question. What do you think, Christy?
Well, it's really confusing because asthma, reactive airways, it's all sort of a spectrum of the lungs reacting and sort of spasming due to various things that are irritating them. And so that can go on to sort of long-term asthma. But a lot of times in children and babies, we'll call it reactive airways. May not label a child with asthma if they're just having it when they get a virus or if it's really mild to sort of see how it's going to play out.
Yeah, well, sometimes if you come in the office and you have an elevated blood pressure, we won't call it hypertension the first time. We'll call it elevated blood pressure. So
right.
You come in and you've got a little wheezing and it's reactive airways. We may not call it asthma. We may just call it reactive airways. The second time you come in, we'll probably call it asthma.
And so having that inhaler to use if the child is, if he's coughing and wheezing sounding, sometimes can be helpful information and then go back to the doctor and tell the doctor whether or not it seemed to get better.
Well, that's going to conclude our house calls, Christy. We've had a chance to talk about less of a concern if the tick's not been on for a very long time?
About older people maybe not needing to get as many tests and blood work done as they get older.
About how to really start understanding your bills that come in. And if you don't believe the charges are right, you might be right.
And about reactive airways. So thanks, you guys, for writing us questions. Thanks for being with us today and joining us on Your Health. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you, that are important to your health. Share your questions on yourhealth@unc.edu, Twitter, Facebook, our blog, our new health app.
Search Your Health Radio on, or just Your Health on Google or iPhones, and let us know what you think. We'd like to thank the staff at WCHL, the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. William Roper. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And we will look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.